entitled The Pursuit of Control and Its Dependency Myths. A couple of things I need to mention to you. Attendance is by ticket or card only. If you don't have a ticket, I've got some extra ones. Come and get one from me. Claude Burtenshaw resides in Logan, Utah. He's an emeritus professor of political science, a former college president, and university vice president. He attended Ricks College and received his master's degree and PhD from the University of Utah. He has worked in the Idaho legislature, both the House and the Senate, and has been a member of the Logan City Council. He's also been a Democratic Party chairman in the county for 10 years. His wife is Frances, and I believe she's here, and they have 8 children, 45 grandchildren, and 8 great-grandchildren. It's a pleasure to introduce Dr. Burtenshaw.
Well, I'm pleased to be with you. Is there something here I pin on me? Does this work?
Yeah.
Just before we started, there was another group in here listening to Kirby, the columnist, and they were having a hilarious time. And I was reminded, don't try to say anything funny because it's all been said. But I should caution you that when I prepared that little thing that appeared in the program, I was just chatting with Albert, and we were trying to determine if I had a topic that I could be explored, and I mentioned this kind of topic possibility. Well, he said, I think that sounds pretty good. Just send me a little blurb that we can put in the program. I wrote up the thing, and the next morning we left for Russia. My wife and I had a trip. When I got back and read that blurb, I couldn't remember what it was I was thinking. And so for the last 2 or 3 weeks, I've been trying to figure out what it was I meant to say when I wrote what is in the program. So if this doesn't resemble anything like that, it was because I didn't discover what I was thinking. But I'll try here. A father reported to me that his 17-year-old son was no longer doing his house chores and other assigned tasks. I have grounded him, he said, refused him the use of the car, and denied him his weekly allowances. He refuses to talk to me. His careless behavior disrupts the whole family. What's left for me to do? I'm just doing what a father's supposed to. A retail merchant confided in me about his dismissal of an employee who was on 3 occasions late to work. I warned him, he said, about his tardiness and threatened his dismissal if he did it again. I've had to dismiss other employees lately who have failed to keep the store rules. What can I do? A university biology teacher confessed to me that he gave a D grade to a good student turning in an assignment a day late. The teacher said he had reminded the student, you knew the deadline, but then he asked me, what else can I do to ensure that the students do their assigned work? A bishop friend of mine denied a fairly active ward member, a temple recommend, to attend his daughter's wedding when he admitted using coffee. How else can I teach members obedience, he asked me. What's a bishop for? A city policeman wondered after giving a ticket to my complaining neighbor that he was only exceeding the speed limit by 5 miles. I hope the ticket and the fine will teach him, he added, that a school zone needs to be protected. How else will drivers learn? Each controller wanted more control. Each controlled felt that there was too much. Why do we submit to control? Why do we accept certain control relationships? Why do we reject some? I hope I find something before I'm through this paper that makes a difference. Even without slavery, which was abolished 133 years ago, there are many human relationships where total control is involved. The pursuit of people to control people is pervasive. Where did the pursuit begin? This may be only an extension of the human need to control the natural environment. The pursuit to control the weather created enclosures, heated and eventually air-cooled buildings, and creations of comfortable warm clothing. The pursuit to control and satisfy hunger brought the invention of horse-drawn and self-powered machinery and factory-processed food. The pursuit to control transportation needs brought the creation of wagons, automobiles, and airplanes. Pursuing the communication needs brought control over various sound and electromagnetic waves with the inventions of telephone, radio, and TV. Science is the name given to the pursuit to understand and control natural forces. This human pursuit to control nature seemed to have evolved through millenniums with many successes and changing explanations of the environmental forces. The pursuit to control that people impose on each other have been involved from the beginning. The control pursuit has inspired human organizations. Controlling the environment to satisfy human needs have necessitated and inspired many human arrangements between the controller and the controlled. I don't know why this is drying me up. The world is full of organizations that claim authority to control both members and non-members. Leadership roles are created in each organization with control responsibilities. Parents, teachers, merchants, librarians, doctors, policemen, all suggest controller arrangements. Child, student, customer, reader, patient, and citizen are words attached to these correspondent roles of the controlled. The controller-controlled relationships are so common that they are hardly noticed. The conflicts, however, that arise from them constantly demand attention. What are the issues between a controller and the controlled? Is there inherent conflict in the relationship? Or are there other causes? The phenomenon may be of such significance as to suggest an examination of the relationship. In the five examples used to introduce this paper, all of the controllers, father, merchant, teacher, bishop, and a policeman, seem to assume a control which included punishment. None, however, even bothered to mention authority. Each assumed that the right to punish was included in the need to control. Control with punishment was the issue for a mother who recently asked me, "How else do you control a kid?" Her discussion about her kid indicated that she began early in his life with a mothering assignment to spank, to tie him up, withhold favors, and inflict other injuries that she thought would get him to obey. Do we assume that parenting gives authority to control children? Recently, I heard a professional educator, a Dr. Dobson, claim that the downfall of this nation began with the failure of parents to introduce their authoritative controls with a good spanking. "My mother was, when I was five," he said, "gave me the spanking I'll never forget for talking back to her." He then boasted of his life of long respect for authority. "Dr. Spock and his no-spanking method destroyed this country," he concluded. Authority and punishment seemed to him to be what control was about. Political organization seems to agree with Dr. Dobson. Their need to control their need to control all their citizens calls for sufficient policemen to impose the necessary punishment. The 13th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution that prohibited slavery specifically did not prohibit political punishment. Does this suggest that the need for the punitive tools establishes the source of its authority? Does this suggest that the need for punitive tools establishes the controlled citizens who control or who continue to resist policemen often question their authority? They also wonder about punishment, its purpose, and its effectiveness. Mormons, from their beginning, have pursued control and been pursued by controllers. They early announced that they were restoring a nation, the ancient political Israel. While in conflict with political authority, however, a scripture was given that identified and gave warning about controllers and their definition of a non-punitive method. From the Liberty Jail in Missouri in 1839, while imprisoned, Joseph Smith gave instruction in a letter, we know it as the 121st section, which dealt with control, its authority, and a preferred method. From the the priesthood that granted authority to control other men, Smith wrote, must be heavenly granted, but was not to exercise compulsion unrighteously. We have learned by sad experience, he warned, that it is the nature and disposition of almost all men, when they get a little authority, as they suppose, they will immediately begin to exercise unrighteous dominion, that is, control. Authority and dominion were a prime concern. What made dominion unrighteous was not made clear unless found in this caution. No power or influence can or ought to be maintained by virtue of the priesthood, only by persuasion, by long-suffering, by gentleness and meekness, and by love unfeigned. Was it the violation of the persuasive method that made it unrighteous? Not clear, as reproving betimes with sharpness, when moved by the Holy Ghost, was allowed. Does reprove and sharpness, which resembles punishment, change with righteousness? Or did it mean that the righteous control authorized the punitive method? Or did it make punishment persuasive? Whichever, he almost added another dimension to the control question with the word ought. How can or ought, not shall, the priesthood be used to control seemed to be the question he was answering. His conclusion was that unrighteous dominion, control, the misuse of authority brought a withdrawal of authority to control. The persuasive method was how control ought to be used. He did not, however, distinguish or discuss the political controls. Politics did not appear to him to need to be distinguished, but he clearly distinguished the punitive method from the persuasive one. A third method of control by some observers is offering rewards or pay as incentive for desired behavior. What parent or grandparents has not tried this? We can observe that everybody and every organization uses it. These are called wages, salaries, bonuses, bribes, gifts, and various other enticements. Rewards to control behavior, however, can also be used punitively, by denying or reducing the rewards. Dismissing an employee which ends his salary is usually perceived as punishment. In theory, at least, there are three distinguishable control methods, but in practice they seem to become less distinguishable as they overlap and run together. For example, as a father says to his 16-year-old driver son, the family car now is available for you to drive. We'll arrange a schedule for when and how long you can take it. But if you do not keep the schedule, we'll deny your use of the car. The teacher tells the class that these are the requirements of the course. For total completion, I will give an A grade. Anything less than the full requirement will be deducted from the 100 that equals the A to a lower grade. Merchants offer a 2% reduction for cash payments for a new washing machine if paid within 30 days. But a 1% penalty will be added for each delinquent day. All of these situations suggest a controller's friendly invitation to pay with rewards, rules, and punishment for failure to comply. Is persuasion only successful when supported by punishment? Do the controlled who are persuaded comply only to escape punishment? Are rewards just another kind of persuasion, a prelude to punishment? In spite of the difficulties of identifying them, separating them helps to understand what control and what these problems are. What is the pursuit to control? I'm still drying up here. Let me interrupt just a second. Made me think. One time I was invited to introduce the Vice President of the United States. And as I helped him get himself arranged on the pulpit, I brought him out a glass of water. And he said, "Don't give that to me." Then he turned and said to me, "But bring it out in a few minutes." So when he's about halfway through his speech, I brought out this glass of water. To say, "What is that?" he said. I said, "Water. Never touch it," he said. I like it. Authority to control is another matter. Where does it come from? Even though finding its source is difficult, it warrants a name. For want of a better name, I'll use the word myth. This word was similarly used by the Greeks to identify their control source. Zeus was their mythical supreme god that authorized to the control of all other gods and the people. Myth does not mean imaginary or untrue. Simply sometimes historical can have mythical dimensions beyond the facts. We often tell mythical stories to illustrate principles. Or we may use ideals or ideas we cannot prove, but are useful. For my purpose, myth is simply a useful word. The political organization that claims to control, that claims to authorize control, thrives on conflict. Is conflict its source? This is where and how the myth is introduced. That which is needed to legitimize and attract, which exists above the conflict of those who are in pursuit of the control, is called the state. The state is the mythical entity which claims, like Zeus, to authorize absolute supremacy over subjected people and property. Another statement reporting the very early beginning of the myth can be noted in the Old Testament. Moses, after separating the Israelite people from the nation of Egypt, found them stateless, without control. At Sinai, Moses, by divine decree, announced the establishment of a new state, a nation. From Sinai, Moses declared the source of supreme authority with exclusive lawmaking power. "I am the Lord thy God," Moses recorded Jehovah saying, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me. I am a jealous God." Moses made this declaration, he said, from the mouth of the God that led them out of Egypt. This thundering proclamation came while that God was being replaced with a golden calf. This mythical state authorized the nation of Israel. With this authority, Moses strapped swords on the Levites with which to control by punishment, and on that day, killing 3,000 men. Perhaps I should add the word Zeus or Sinai to this political myth. This jealous-like, punitive, supreme control feature, characteristic of the state. Thousands of years later, and after the beginning of hundreds of political institutions, this Sinai-like myth still exists. A current example can be noted in the United States in the Clinton-Lewinsky case. The issue before the special counsel, we are told, is not about adulterous sex. We are continually reminded that the issue is whether Clinton lied about it under oath to the state. His promiscuous sex is not a concern, but he cannot lie or tell others to lie about it under oath to the state. That would, says Mr. Starr, compromise the state's supremacy. We're reminded that the tool of the state is the law, and its control method is punishment, including fines, jails, and executions. These ultimate punitive tools were authorized by the Sinai myth, the founding of the state. Authority and the jurisdiction it grants are central to the myth. There is no Jehovah, however, authorizing the U.S. beginning, but there is still a myth-like Zeus or Sinai mysteriously hidden in the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, with a flag symbolizing its supremacy, inspiring loyalty and obedience in its citizens. What a powerful myth. This non-personal myth, the state, created an inevitable, inescapable supremacy. Citizen acceptance of this myth inspires loyalty, patriotism, and devotion. These qualities of citizenship that facilitate the state's control are at the heart of the U.S. myth that uses punitive controls. As in ancient Israel, it is with the state's demands of exclusive supremacy that makes crime an offense against the state. All criminal court cases include this designation. The myth gives credibility to the punitive law. The third method, rewards, also used by the state, displays the effects of this mythical power. The state authorizes the government to pay employees and grants various welfare programs from taxes it punitively collects from its citizens. The citizens' belief in the myth is apparently included in the citizens' consent to be governed. With this punitive method and the citizens' belief in it, in the myth, the state authorizes and collects taxes. The reward method, however, is not exclusively used by the state. Citizens can use it too, but its problem is that the controlled easily becomes the controller. It most often has the appearance of a bribe, payola, a near withdrawal of control. A son who is rewarded a $5 for mowing the lawn will soon do it only if dad pays more. A young daughter is paid to keep her room clean, but the mother soon finds out that unless the pay is increased, the room will not be cleaned. The reward method often becomes unaffordable, and the hoped-for control gone. Even the state, the reward method often becomes unaffordable and the control is gone. Dad is back mowing the lawn, and mother is still frustrated about the messy room. Even the state finds rewards ineffective. Note the frantic current efforts to reform the national welfare programs. This tenuous reward control method and its conflicts about pay never ends. Another good example of the employer-employee relationships is when labor organizes. Labor unions have tremendous influence on wage benefit negotiations. Their demands for more benefits never end. And the employer use of the control over employees are weakened, if not gone. Does the political myth that authorizes control and the use of the punitive method extend to all non-political relationships, like a parent, child, or a teacher, student? Are there no other authorizing control sources? Who authorizes and controls marriage, abortion? Who forbids child and spouse abuse? Who authorizes and controls business organizations? Who authorizes and controls education, schools, attendance, curriculum? Who regulates sanitation, food preparation, drugs, and health care? Who authorizes the use of automobiles? Who builds and controls roads? Who controls airways for both communication and transportation? Who authorizes these controls and how they are implemented? Does the state myth authorize the political control of everything? Anybody awake? Are there no unclaimed areas that have accepted, are there no unclaimed areas that have escaped the punitive method? If there is an unclaimed area, it may only be a conflict away from being included. Does this pervasiveness obligate parents to introduce the ways of the political myth, meaning that Dr. Robson's mother, referred to earlier, with the spanking, was correctly teaching the respect for the mythical state and obedience to it? Does this make obedience to control a prime purpose for human existence? Like ancient Israel, does even the discussion of other gods become criminal? The U.S. Bill of Rights has something to say about this discussion. But even setting the conflicts, even protecting the conflicts about its limits, too depends upon the myth. There is another myth, however, that may authorize another control source and method. This myth includes a prominent principle of Mormonism called agency. Agency is central to a larger claim called morality. Like the political myth, the source of morality's authority is difficult to discover. There are many disbelievers in its existence. The disbelievers question whether people are free and can make choices that affect their destiny. Believers in the myth, however, admit to the difficulty of finding its beginning and even more to proving it. Still, it authorizes a persuasive method. The morality myth claims that agency, with some implied freedom from natural forces, which came with each individual, provides the capacity to be responsible and to develop and use self-imposed standards. It also claims that all individuals, even young ones, are equal in their pursuit to control. Believing this central to accepting the existence of morality and the persuasive method, the myth authorizes individual responsibility for settling conflicts in a way that avoids political controls. The morality myth, even though it recognizes the need to control, includes the words ought in the persuasive method. The Sinai myth, with its punitive methods, uses the word shall, which demands obedience. This ought invites the controller, a father, mother, employer, to respect the capacity of those controlled and to control themselves. The ought invites a child, a student, to be responsible for his behavior. The ought questions obedience as the first law of heaven. The controller begins not with rules, but with sharing plans, purposes, responsibility, and even income. The user of the persuasive method recognizes and accommodates the aspirations and the skills of the controlled. Needed policies and rules are negotiated and understood, leaving enforcement a shared responsibility between controlled. Maintaining the persuasive method authorized by morality suggests that the controller, a parent, a teacher, employee, give attention to the 121st section. It warns all controllers about the disposition of almost all men that when they get a little authority, they show it off, jealously guard it, and capriciously use it. Such dominion gives excessive attention to hierarchical relations and to ladder climbers. In frustration, according to the warning, men with a little authority will display anger when frustrated, claiming to be righteously offended, and reprove with sharpness, punishment. Can these traits that authoritative controllers are inclined to use be avoided? Can a controller develop appropriate persuasive tools and use them in kindness, long-suffering, and meekness? Can those who accept the morality in all its mythical power be content with a promise like the one in the 121st section that thy dominion shall be an everlasting dominion, and without compulsory means flow unto thee forever and ever? Can the promise of a friendly relationship between the controller and the controlled get any attention? Does the morality myth have any chance of implementation? Does the nature and disposition of almost all men, with or without authority, controller or controlled, overwhelm the morality myth? Can authority be restrained? Can children, students, customers, patients, employees be responsible to and for the purposes of the controlled relationship? The family may be the best hope, even though in recent years it has fallen under the jurisdiction of the state. The conflicts between parent and child have invited political intrusion. A few years ago, I had a neighbor who was observed beating his 12-year-old son. Fearing for the child, another neighbor called the police. The father spent a few weeks in jail. Since then, many laws have been written prohibiting child and spouse abuse. With these laws, the family's moral independence has been threatened. Can a family yet avoid political controls by accepting the tenets of the morality myth and using the persuasive method? Some religious groups claim that there is a higher political morality, a higher myth, which controls the state. Many American church people believe that the Old Testament Jehovah provides that control. Tom Jefferson Associates, in their Declaration of Independence, claimed that a natural law was the morality that superseded and controlled the state. Winning the War of Independence against the immoral British government, they claimed, gave it credibility. Winning the war, however, seemed simply to relocate the state with its punitive method. The state myth that authorized the British control over the colonies eventually authorized the United States, which thrives on the myth, much as did the British before the colonies were separated. Some writers claim that it may have been the political morality myth that provoked the revolutionary conflict, but it was the punitive state that settled it. It was even more. The Declaration and the war secularized the Sinai myth, political morality, then ceased to be a religious one. In this paper, I have intended to examine the conflicts between the pervasive controller-controlled relationships and their dependency on a myth. My reasons were to understand situations brought to me by students, parents, citizens from my more than 50 years at all levels of education and 35 years at most levels of politics. I saw the impact of control where it happened. I doubt that I ever contributed much, but it continually puzzled me. This paper has not solved the puzzle. I hope I hope it helps us to understand it. I have said the control relationships were inescapable, involving two issues: authority and method. Authority to control, I suggested, needs a myth. I have suggested two: the state and morality. I have noted the two myths are often in conflict, and when they are, the state myth wins. I have also explained that in any controller-controlled conflict, the state's government may be appealed to. Its government seems quite ready to add to its jurisdiction and impose settlement. Many practitioners doubt the morality myth. They think it is too elusive to offer much control. Its religious identity adds for them to its failure. It is only a Christian dream with impractical hopes. The three control methods, I said, are not easily distinguished, but usefully separated. The dominant one, called the punitive, is the main, if not the only one, used by the state. The control tool of the state, the law without policemen, fines, jails, and execution, has no effect. Every lawbreaker may be punished if the state, by law, with its punitive method, excuse me, what I threw away part of my show, regulates the use by its citizens. That is not very different from what Moses did at Sinai, who forbade the use of punishment by anyone but the state. He did this with five of the Ten Commandments that prohibited injuring others in any of the following ways: killing, adultery, stealing, bearing false witness, and coveting. The recent political prohibitions against child and spouse abuse may be a reminder of those five commandments. The method called rewards is used by everyone, but when used by the state, becomes punitive with taxes. Rewards as such, I noted, was an ineffective control used by anyone, unless, however, used by individuals as kindness, not controls. The method called persuasive seemed only possible before politics. The method is noted in the propaganda of selling, teaching, writing, preaching, proselyting, and other work of volunteer organizations, each with their own myths. The method is explanations, arguments, and reasoning instruction about what ought to be done according to their separate myths. I mentioned problems raised by separating persuasion and punishment, disagreement and discussion about consequences, I said, however, are part of the persuasive method. I have indicated that the two myths are inescapably involved with the controller-controlled relationships. The way they are involved depends on the intensity of the conflicts. The state myth, with wide acceptance of its supreme power, overwhelms believers in the morality myth. I hope I have implied, however, that the morality myth has possibilities for believers in it. I also want to conclude that I observe that the state myth and the punitive method are full of disappointments and many, many failures. I must finally say that the pursuit to control that came with each of us makes us conflicting competitors in an open arena and will need controls. I am also convinced that a search for a best method is useful. Understanding the two myths and their dependency on controls on them, I believe, is the beginning of the search. Thank you.
We have 20 minutes for questions. I'd love you to ask Dr. Burntshaw whatever you'd like, and I'll just repeat the question so that it will be recorded on the tape.
I'll leave this on. No one's awake. You've made a great speech. If anyone add to it. I didn't present this, I don't think, to find a solution. I meant to present a problem. And I think I've been accused of that before. But I think what you're saying is that you'd like to hear somebody give an answer. And what I think I'm saying is that mankind has been in search of an answer from the beginning. And I think that's his problem. But my point is, I think he has never seen the problem very clearly. And I think to see the problem, I began my teaching career with the elementary school. And when I finished, I was doing graduate teaching and so on. And in the bigger part of that, I was in charge of all the students. I was a vice president of student affairs. Because I wanted to be involved in all they did. But I think I knew every problem that every parent child had, and I saw them in every kind of way that you could think. I remember mother calling me one morning and saying, "Would you give me my son's grades?" And I said, "What is your son's name?" She told me, "Is he a student here?" "Yes." "Why don't you talk to him about those? Why do you call me?" "Well, he won't talk to me." As we discussed it, there was no way in the world for her to get to him with her problem of him misbehaving. I say that only to tell you we all face this kind of control problem. And for me to tell her what to do was, I simply said, "Unless he will tell it to you, you have no answer." I did the same thing with a man who called from back east. He said, "You've had a son of mine there for a year. I've written him. I've talked to him in every way. I've tried to talk to him the way I can. He won't answer my letters. He won't talk. I'm coming out there today," he said, "and I want to find some way to meet him." And I said, "Well, tell me when you're here. And I think maybe I can get him to come to my office and you can come meet him." So he arrived, and I called and got his son. He said, "Sure, I'll come over." And so I'm dad and son met in my office. And I said some kinds of things I thought might make them friends. But the son, he was not about to give in much. But anyway, I got them talking. And finally, as this dad was about to leave, "I see," he said, "I'll have to let you do what you want." And at that point, the son just stopped. "You won't let me do anything." And we soon discovered that was the problem. Dad was still in charge, he thought. And the son was not to be controlled. And there was no way for that to be settled. Now, I don't know how I could answer that question, you see, except for the father to admit the new relationship that now was there. Now, in my legislative experiences, I discovered there was never a law proposed that the disputants weren't there on both sides of it. I had a neighbor friend call one night and he said, "Do you know where my farm is?" He was in my district. "The end of a canal company." And he said, "The company doesn't have any waste for the water. And the water, two or three times in the summer, just floods 20 acres of my land. I want the law written so they'll have to do something else with their water, wastewater." So I got the law out and I got an attorney. We wrote a solution to the whole thing. I introduced it, and within 24 hours I had all 36 water companies call me. And their concern was, "We don't know how to control our water, and if we did what you're saying in that law, it'll cost us millions of dollars." Well, that's the problem, you see. I don't know the solution, but my neighbor friend said, "You ought not to waste my land." Now, I can run through, well, I once reviewed over the 1,100 pieces of legislation introduced in two sessions of the legislature, and I found that every one of them had a conflict going before they got to the point we wrote the law. Now, you're asking me, is there a solution to that? And I guess we would like to say we either ought to settle them before we get to the legislature, or even worse, to the court, you see, And our whole life is made up of these kinds of conflicts and the political system we've arranged to settle them. But as I've indicated, it uses the punitive method, and most of the time that just increases the conflict. It doesn't really solve it, because after it's over, we've written the law, they regroup to come back and get the law rewritten. Do you see? And I think you've raised the question in a great way, you see. We would like to know what to do, and the answer is what? Well, we can't stop the conflicts. All we need to do is find a way to resolve them, and if there's a way to resolve them in a friendly way, that would be better. If not, we'll impose a solution in the punitive political method. Have I made the made it worse? But you see the problem, and you see the solution, you see. And if we could find ways, if I were to run through the, at least 2,000, maybe more than that, bills introduced in the United States Congress a year, I would tell you about that many conflicts. And conflicts are inviting resolutions, and most of them have no way except through the state, which is a punitive method. And we would try somehow, best we can, to resolve them in another way. And I'm not sure there is another way. You see, we must somehow or other relate to that kind of an issue or those kinds of issues in the best way we can without destroying each other. Yes?
No, I'm still trying to understand your use of the word myth. There are contractual circumstances, like you were talking about. People give other people control on the basis of contracts. You have an agreement as to who's got the power and what the price of it is. In religious situations, you have the myth. Do you know that Moses went up to the mountain? There was Hammurabi before him who had the commandments that were quite similar to what Moses brought from the mountain. That, in my mind, would be the category of myth. How much fact do we have?
Yeah.
And in our day and age, pardon me for saying so, but the priesthood and Jehovah and Joseph Smith have a big part of myth in it. Is it God we're dealing with?
Yes.
If you want to believe that.
Yes, you've said it well, you see.
Will you repeat your question?
Pardon?
Will you repeat your question?
The question you've asked is, how am I using the word myth, and where does it exist?
In relationship to power.
Yes.
Because there are various areas of power, and unless you give power to somebody, unless I believe that the priesthood is from God and all men have it or inspired, I don't have that control.
See, we're asking the question you've asked now. Where do we go to get the authority to do what we're doing? And we're saying there is a mythical something called the state. Nobody knows what it is. We haven't seen it. You can't touch it. It's there, and to believe it's there puts it there. God does for the church, the religion, what the state does for politics. You create this imaginary something because you like to believe it authorizes who it is that's in charge. The state authorizes the United States government to do what it does. But we put that thing right inside the Constitution, and the Constitution says it. The 6th article of the Constitution: this Constitution and all laws made in pursuance thereof shall be the supreme law of the land. We just moved the myth inside of the Constitution. It's what you believe is supreme.
It's almost the chicken and egg
question. Oh, it's worse than that.
If you don't want to obey the power, do away with the myth.
Ah, yeah, that's right. You've got to.
Solution.
So then you go somewhere else to create one just like it.
And then you're aware that you created it.
Yes. You can't really talk about it that way because it's your source of authority. Where did Joseph Smith get his authority? You point to the sacred grove. If you believe in that, you can establish all the rest of the things of the church. If you don't, it doesn't exist.
Then the myth has no power.
Well, the myth has no power unless you believe in it.
Right.
Believing in it makes it so.
Right.
Yes?
About 300 to 400 years. years B.C. when Pericles made his famous Athens freedom of speech, or freedom of speech of Athens, the speech on freedom about Athens. Was he demything the state of Athens and then opening the door for a stronger mythical state to come in and take as part of
Christianity? Sure, yeah. Question.
Yes. You're asking me what Pericles did, or I mean what Solon, or you could.
I'm wondering if this has application to longevity of a nation.
Oh, well, I suspect it may do. You see, and it may do. When enough people can't accept the supremacy place, the source of authority, then it does fall away, you see. And so the myth kind of thing. One of the most unusual things about the writer of the Constitution is they were searching for a place to do what something had never been done. And the genius of the Constitution was that they said, well, this is it. We're writing now the supreme thing. And we hope it can be accepted as this mythical thing. And then they said, to make sure that it's like it is, we're going to divide the power. We're going to have separation of powers. We're going to have popular things. There are about five or six things, they said, were there, and they are not much more than issues. But to believe they're there puts us on up to where the myth is. And on my whole point of what I wanted to say today, we're so dependent on myths to run our system, you see, that to destroy it would destroy the system. You said it right. That's what you wanted to say, wasn't it? The myth and our acceptance of them about the source of power, of control. Yes?
Could you come up and repeat it in the mic? Because the questions are often long.
Me?
Do you mind? Yes.
Oh. Are we running out of time? Oh, yeah.
We got 5 minutes.
Talk into that.
Did the myth of the Ten Commandments have a subsequent control?
That the Ten Commandments were the result of the myth, you see. Moses gave those, you see, and he gave them as though Jehovah were giving them. Moses had established the myth. He went up to Sinai. And he came down and said, I've been speaking with Jehovah. As near as they could tell, they had not seen Jehovah. They had only heard the word. Moses went up a couple of times and he came back in great anger, you see. And what he was trying to say to them was, I've gotten the authority now to give you commandments. And he gave them. And then when he got through, he found out they weren't working, so he added the punishment. And God said, strap those swords on those Levites and send them out to impose punitively. 3,000 of them, it said, were killed in one day. Which then, he said, that and what I've told you makes what you need to believe in to make Israel flourish. Is that...
This brings a query of priesthood control. And the Levites, as I understand it, were the Aaronic priesthood. And what would be the effect then of both the Aaronic priesthood and with Moses, the Melchizedek priesthood?
Well, as you have indicated, the Levites was the lesser priesthood. And they seem to have a temporary, something lesser than the Melchizedek. Moses, as we presume now, held the Melchizedek, but Aaron introduced a lesser priesthood. The Aaronic and the Levites, they were the lesser. But their job was imposing the rules. And that must have been the temporal side of the Israelite nation. Is that good enough?
Yes.
Are we out of time yet?
We got one question.
Yes.
You need to come up.
I can say that loudly. You've been somewhat negative about what a myth is. No, I haven't.
Yeah, I haven't meant to be negative.
My suspicion is that as a myth brings about good things and good works, it gains a strength of its own that would rise sort of above what you have a myth be.
So when you're talking about the downfall of a country or something like that, if the myth that's created there, if its works are bad or oppressive, it will lose its strength.
Now what I'm saying is your belief in the myth makes it work. And what you see in it, you see what we've given to our myth, the U.S. myth, makes all of our patriotism, all of our duty. When they called me to war back in 1942, I went as though that was my obligation, and I loved my country. I gave the myth all it needed to make the system work. Now, if you're trying to say that it's a bad thing, you may be referring to the Greek myths we think of as something not true. And I tried to say I didn't know a better word than as they used it, but I was trying to take it out of its general mythological meaning that it wasn't true. But I'm saying we got no place to go to believe in something other than something like their myth, and I tried to say it that way, like the Greek myth or like the Israelite myth. We need and use it, and I tried to say in that thing that I didn't know what I meant, we depend on the myth to make controls function.
That's true.
Yes?
Well, your examples seem to show that the problem finally is that whatever the myth is, it has its positive value for some, but it has its challenges.
Oh, yes. And I said in the thing that makes all of this begin, initiate, is a conflict. And the conflicts are hard to resolve or to dissolve, and we all hate to be losers, and it's somewhere in that myth that finally lets us accept finally our losses and then to progress without going to revolution. The early colonies, they had stood all they could, they said, and they wouldn't accept it. The revolution broke out. The British myth fell apart.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hayden Shaw.
Thank you.